Hi, I'm Lorna Slater.
And I'm Patrick Harvey.
And we're the co-leaders of the Scottish Green Party. How are you today, Patrick?
I'm pretty well. We've all been recharging our batteries a little bit after party conference season, and the Greens were up in Inverness. It's been a pretty hectic time getting conference organised, but it was really upbeat and people were really looking forward to the next year and a half in the run-up to the 2021 election.
So today we're going to talk a bit about our conference and about conference season. And of course, it's Super Saturday. We're sitting here in front of the parliamentary debate, so we'll have a bit of discussion about that at the end as well. And we're going to have a special extra podcast on Monday, to talk about the result, whatever that might be.
Yeah, because maybe by the time you listen to this, you know what the result is. But we're sat here at the moment listening to the titan that is Clive Efford, Labour MP for Eltham. I don't know how he's going to be voting, but obviously the whole Commons is packed and they're debating this. And it's extraordinary that they're going to be voting on this deal just 2 days after having seen it. You know, it's the lack of scrutiny, apart from everything else, is just such contempt for the democratic process. But we'll come to that later.
Absolutely. So conference last weekend, as you said, a very busy time. I know some people sort of slept for 10 hours on Monday when they got home. And thanks to everyone who helped organize that conference and everyone who attended. So conference is a very important part of our party's democratic processes, but it's also loads of fun. And one of the highlights of it was that we announced our candidates for the 2021 Holyrood elections, where we're hoping to get a whole bunch more Green MSPs elected, the largest Green group ever.
Absolutely, yeah. There's so much enthusiasm about this election, not just because we're really clear what it is we want to be saying. We'll come on to some of the policy ideas around the Green New Deal in a few minutes, but the candidates that we've got selected, including, I know you put in so much work to make sure that the Women's Network were really active in encouraging women, trans and non-binary candidates to stand. We've got a great diverse bunch of candidates, but we've also got, I think, this moment of recognition of the urgency of the climate emergency and the level of political, social and economic change that is demanded of us if we want to really respond to the climate emergency in a coherent way. I think people are getting the scale of change and the sense of urgency, and you see that in the activism that's happening at the moment through the youth strike movement and XR and so on. I think people are going to be seeing this election. Obviously, the constitutional issues will play large. People know where the Greens stand on that. But this is going to be a climate election as well. This is going to be a moment where Scotland has to decide, are we ready to ambitiously embrace that transition?
In my conference speech where we announced the candidates, I spoke about how proud I was of everyone who stood forward and about how much courage that takes, particularly for women, and even more so for trans women and women of colour and disabled women.
Absolutely.
And the number one question that we were asked, the Women's Network were asked by women and non-binary people who were thinking of standing, is about abuse on social media. And so I really want to applaud the courage of everyone who did stand forward, because it does take a lot to sort of put your head above the parapet there. Immediately that you're in the public eye, you get assessed on how you look, how you behave, you trolls on social media start making your life a misery. And to kind of say, I believe in this, I believe in the values of the Scottish Green Party, I believe in peace, equality, sustainability, I believe in a greener, independent Scotland, I believe in radical local democracy, and I will put myself through this because of my beliefs to make my community a better place. I'm so proud of these women and non-binary people for having the courage to stand forward. I just found the whole thing really moving, that we put the call out saying, please stand, and people did.
Absolutely. And it's also a vote of confidence, I think, in our ability to change politics, because you look at politics on a surface level and you do see this hostility, the violent language, the abuse, not to mention the social media, as you mentioned. But actually, once you get out knocking on doors, you meet real people, not Twitter trolls, and you have real conversations, and you recognise that politics is capable of being something much more elevated than it looks like on TV or on the social media. So that's the kind of campaigning that we need to be doing. And I know that we've got good, strong campaign teams around the country, not just the candidates, so many more people organizers, campaigners, volunteers, canvassers, getting out there, putting their time and energy into making sure that we get the best and biggest Green group in the Scottish Parliament and councillors the year after that, but also making sure that we conduct ourselves in a decent way and show that politics can be better than it often looks through the distorted lens of social media.
I think that's it, isn't it? Is demonstrating through how we behave that politics can be done differently. It is possible to have politics where we work through negotiation and consensus and cooperation. We don't just shout at each other and scream obscenities across the aisle and make these sort of hooting noises that you hear. You know, like this sort of, and to me, I didn't go to a private school. I'm a foreigner. I grew up in a different country. This sort of old Etonian kind of stuff that's around Westminster, I don't think you get so much that in Holyrood. My feeling is, and certainly I've spoken to Alison Johnson about this, because she, when she's, you know, helping support us get women into Parliament, is that it's not like that in Holyrood.
Yeah, I mean, there are, of the MSPs, there's a smaller proportion who come from that kind of elite privileged background, the private schools, the Oxbridge education and so on. And some of the behaviour of Westminster is very much culturally rooted in that kind of, you know, not just the elitism and the privilege, but the age of deference as well. People who expect people simply just to defer to them because they've got a posh voice, and that is somehow equated with cleverness or authority, and it isn't. But I think some of the behaviour in Holyrood can also be tribal. It's not quite in the same voice, it's not quite in the same register, but it can be tribal with, you know, people thinking that one particular issue, whether it's the, you know, Brexit issue or independence, is the be-all and end-all. You can passionately disagree about an issue like independence and still find some common ground on something like fairer taxation. You can passionately agree on something like independence and still disagree about, let's say, the role of the oil and gas industry in Scotland's future, for example. And some of those issues did come up in the policy sessions that we had at party conference. When we're, you know, just a wee while ago, as we said in our last podcast, we launched the Green New Deal paper. That's a discussion paper that will hopefully develop as our branches and activists feed into it. But we had a number of sessions about the Green New Deal concept, trying to develop what does a Scottish Green New Deal look like. And we had some great guest speakers and some great plenary sessions as well as policy debates. What were the highlights for you from that kind of theme within the conference?
I think there were two sessions I went to where I really learned something new or found something, there was something phrased in a new way. And one was on the energy transition. So I work in renewable energy. So it's something that I feel, I was on the panel. But one of the other panelists said something that it sounds so obvious when you actually say it out loud, but I hadn't really clocked it before, which was that we have to pick a date at which to stop fossil fuel extraction. Now, we can argue about when that date is. Some parties are saying decades in the future. We're saying less than a decade. But whether or not you want that date to be nearer or further away, there is still a date upon which we need to stop fossil fuel extraction. And I thought that was a really interesting way of visualizing it. You know, pick a date in the future and we ramp down. We ramp down production, we ramp down, and we know how many workers we need to find new jobs for. We know how much infrastructure we need to repurpose. And that somehow just gave a framework to me for the project. I'm a project manager, so I think of everything as projects. But to me, that suddenly became a project. It stopped being a sort of airy-fairy pie in the sky and a sort of, no, we're going to stop producing this stuff by, let's say, 2030. And here's the job that we need to do to plan.
Yeah, it's interesting that you see that as a project manager. That, I think, speaks a little bit to the fact that we are not a party that says the free market will deliver. All we have to do is keep the business of small government ticking over and the market will deliver. The market will not. The market will fail us. If we allow this change to happen in an unmanaged way without seeing it as a project to take responsibility for, then huge numbers of people's lives will be disrupted. When economic change happens and we haven't planned for it, Scotland's seen that before with deindustrialisation. whole communities left on the economic scrap heap. We cannot afford to see that happen again. We shouldn't be willing to tolerate that. We do need to plan for this. And, you know, having a timescale to reduce not only production, but also to reduce our consumption, to reduce our reliance economically, but also technologically on fossil fuels, hydrocarbons as fuels and as chemical feedstock, because those other industries are going to have to change. That could be an area where Scotland really leads, really innovates and creates new economic opportunities that are sustainable, that are not about, you know, ever more growth for forever of you know, at any cost, but are about generating new opportunities that can exist for the long term.
And there's a good example of that this week. It's sort of a slight divergence. So I've often spoken about how the company that I work for in my day job, we're building our tidal turbine in Dundee. But the first steel was rolled this week, and it was rolled in Fife at a heavy fabrication yard there. So moving away from fossil fuels doesn't mean a loss of heavy manufacturing or heavy fabrication or any of those sort of shipbuilding industries. There are plenty of sustainable green industries we can transition to. There is somewhere to go. And, you know, in Dundee, they're trying to recruit technical workers and engineers and you know, the shipyard workers back, because there's now work to do that isn't fossil fuel based. It's really exciting.
Absolutely. And there was another session as well where we brought together Stephen Smellie from the trade union movement, but also Catherine Trebeck, the awesome, amazing Catherine Trebeck, who's spoken at our conferences
Wasn't
before.
Wasn't that good, yeah.
But who's involved in the Wellbeing Alliance. And this was a discussion not just about the nuts and bolts, quite literally, of how an economy works and where manufacturing is going to go and so on, but also what does an economy mean? You know, where does well-being sit within the basis of what is the economy for? What are we trying to achieve here, rather than just GDP figures? Because you can't eat GDP figures. And if growth happens, but the people who are least in need of that extra economic wealth are hoarding it, you know, that's not growth that's in anyone's interest other than that tiny minority who don't need it. So that was a session that I think we were both in. How did you react to that one?
So I think Catherine's most retweeted slide was the one where she said the system isn't broken. The economic system isn't broken. It's designed to work this way. The economic system, the neoliberal capitalism that we've all been living under for decades and decades, is designed to make a few people billionaires while leaving millions in poverty. And that's exactly what we can see in the UK. There are 150 billionaires in the UK and 12.5 million people in poverty. Mm. And that's not because the system's broken. The system was designed to do exactly that. And so under a Green New Deal, we would be restructuring that economy, rethinking about where the levers of power are that allow money to flow where it's needed. Billionaires don't need more money, but our existing system is all about making sure they get more money and making sure that money moves through the economy. And instead of being trapped in offshore tax havens or in unproductive assets like residential housing stock, where as they go up and up in value, they actually get less valuable in terms of housing because they're being so busy being an investment that actually you can't put families in them because you have to use it as an Airbnb. And, you know, like it just makes the whole thing dysfunctional.
Yeah, this fetishization of extreme wealth is extraordinary. And the way that so many other parties talk about, you know, growing the number of millionaires and billionaires as though that's something positive. At the same weekend at our conference, there was this other thread going around on Twitter asking people how long you would need to have earned the basic wage of an ordinary Amazon warehouse worker to accumulate the wealth that Jeff Bezos has. And people were guessing these extraordinary numbers. It's breathtaking. You would have had to earn every day what an Amazon warehouse worker earns in a year. You'd need to have been earning that since before the invention of money for that total to equate to, for that total to equate to what Jeff Bezos has accumulated. Billionaires are not billionaires because they have worked hard for it. Billionaires are billionaires because we have an economic system that allows them to hoard the wealth that other people have generated.
It's something you've talked about, I've heard you speak about before, about when is enough wealth enough? And I think that there's a some really good questions around that, because I certainly don't object to people who work hard being rewarded for prudence and good investment. But there's a point at which you have some people, a very few small number of people, have not only enough wealth to live their entire lives out in comfort, but their children and grandchildren as well. And so if you're accumulating more wealth than you and your kids and your grandkids will ever need to live your whole lives out in comfort, then what do you need that wealth for? And that the answer to that is that you need that wealth to accumulate power and to wield Absolutely. Power. And then you have wealth distorting democracy, because we maintain the illusion that we live in a one vote, you know, powers, you have the same power as anyone else. Well, that isn't true when election spending is so high, when you can, you know, you've got the Brexit party, Arron Banks buying beautiful posters and boards everywhere and branding and sort of stuff. You know, we're a party like the Scottish Greens, we depend on, you know, £3 a month from each of our members, you know, to keep going. We can't compete on a level playing field while power is being wielded by money.
No, you're right. And it comes back to other work that Catherine was speaking about. Catherine Trebeck was speaking about the Wellbeing Alliance is what they're doing at the moment. Wellbeing is for some people, it's a bit of a nebulous term. That's simply because it's hard to measure. GDP is easy to measure and means less, but we measure it because it's easy. Well, the Humankind Index was an earlier project that Catherine and I were both working on, which began asking people the question, what do you need to live well in your community? And trying to use the answers to generate a set of economic indicators that could be an alternative approach. And what was interesting about the answers so often was that, yeah, there were parts of it that were about non-material things like having a you know, good health, having a you know, decent environment, having enough time to spend with your family and your friends. You know, some of those are about resources, but they're not entirely material. The answers that were about material stuff, having money, were all about having enough. They were about having enough money to pay the bills, enough money to be able to have a holiday every year. The people answering these questions were not aspiring to vast, gargantuan hoarding of wealth. They were not aspiring to opulence and lavish, you know, lifestyles. They were looking for enough. And I think people, for the most part, understand the concept of enough in a way that a lot of economists don't seem to.
So in terms of economy, what does a Green New Deal look like right now in Scotland, for example, on our Scottish budget?
Well, that's the big issue. And we have the responsibility to take these big ideas and turn them into something practical, something meaningful. And there was a big debate, you know, after these plenary sessions had happened at conference, there was a debate on how should we approach the forthcoming budget. And we always do this. We want to make sure that we're respecting the views and priorities of our members at conference when we go into the budget process in Parliament. So we had a debate, and there was an amendment from one of our colleagues in Glasgow looking to put some more detail into what a Green New Deal budget, a climate emergency budget, would look like. And so we do have, you know, some proposals that we're going to be putting to the Scottish Government around things like moving toward free public transport. We probably can't get there in a single leap, in a single budget, but we need to be making progress toward that. We need to be shifting the capital spend much faster. We've already got the Scottish Government to start shifting the capital budget away from high carbon toward low carbon, but that needs to accelerate. You know, things like greater investment in district heating. There's a huge opportunity, but a great urgency as well. If we're going to meet those climate targets, we need to be getting cities like Glasgow and Edinburgh on large scale off the gas grid and give people renewable heating systems that will be affordable and sustainable. That's harder to do in rural communities where there's a much more expansive, you know, less centralised kind of housing kind of density. But in areas where you've got high housing density, that can be done. It is affordable so long as the government steps in. And there are other elements of a green economy, like, you know, there's been debate within the Greens, within some in the SNP and Labour as well, about moving to a four-day week, the same pay for fewer hours. And there's a good deal of evidence that actually people are more productive if they're less exhausted and if they're getting a shorter working week for the same pay, you can have the same level of productivity.
More exercise, more sleep, more social contact.
So again, this isn't something that the Scottish government, with the current devolved powers, can just snap its fingers and make that happen. But we could be starting to pilot that and trial it within the public sector. So we're keen to see if there's opportunity to do stuff like that. And the Just Transition Commission that exists at the moment, the Scottish government weren't willing to give it a statutory basis. We want to have a conversation with them about where's that going to go? How's that going to turn into a delivery body that will actually start to implement the ideas that the commission at the moment has been tasked with talking about? We need to turn the talking into doing.
I have a question. This is maybe more of a specific question that's not actually budget related. You said about making public transport, well, gradually cheaper or cheap or free for certain.
We'd like to make it free for everybody.
So in Edinburgh, I live in Edinburgh, Patrick lives in Glasgow. In Edinburgh, we have a bus system, one bus system covering the city, which is partially publicly owned. Mm. And it's a very good system, Patrick. We're very lucky to have it.
Well, it's certainly,
and I can see that as it's being it's publicly owned.
Better than first bus in Glasgow.
Well, that's it. So my understanding is that in Glasgow, you've got several different bus companies and it's a bit more. So how does that work when bus companies are not publicly owned? How can we drive down prices? Or smooth being free?
I mean, there's an element of it which is about subsidy. And whatever the ownership structure, whether you've got private bus companies or a publicly owned bus company, if you want cheap, affordable public transport, or preferably free public transport, that involves subsidy. You cannot think it's just going to run on a self-financing market basis. Even if it was a publicly owned company, it requires subsidy in order to achieve that. Our view is that publicly owned companies are much more likely to be run in the public interest. And if they do generate a profit, that profit should come back to the public purse rather than just being extracted, as it is in so many industries, by private owners.
And then hidden in tax havens.
Yeah.
There's no use to anyone.
There was a presentation I was at just recently that Transform Scotland, the sustainable transport campaign group, hosted in Glasgow with the Deputy Mayor of Vienna, a Green, naturally. But there was so much transformation she was talking about there, about what they'd achieved. You know, they're not a car-free city, but they're on the transition, they're on the journey to becoming a car-free city. They've dramatically reduced the amount of private car use, but also the reliance people have on their private car because they've invested in the alternatives.
Mm.
They ensure that there's good, high-quality, dense and affordable housing in the city so that people can afford to live within those easy travel-to-work areas by bike, by foot and by public transport. They've made public transport very, very cheap. It's not quite free, but it's €1 a day for the entire network, for the entire network, for the city. And, you know, we were all, you know, listening to this. Why can't Glasgow achieve this? What's stopping Edinburgh from achieving this? And then it came on to some of the deeper questions about this long-term social democratic model that's been there. They've not had neoliberalism imposed on them in quite the same way. 60% plus of the housing is either social housing or subsidised affordable housing. In the whole city, the public transport company is obviously publicly owned. A huge amount of land is publicly owned, and that's why they've been able to do things like protecting their green space and constantly investing in creating new green spaces for people to enjoy and making it a really, really child-friendly city as well. So ownership is a hugely important element of the ability to manage your project, to manage your city, to manage your transition.
That's really interesting. So I spoke at a Climate 2050 event the other week with Claire Miller and one of our activists, and there was a young woman from Glasgow who was talking to us about a frustrating campaign she'd been trying to run in Glasgow, where there was a parking lot, I think, that was due to be repurposed, and they and the local community had campaigned to turn it into a park.
Mm.
But because councils are so cash strapped, the council couldn't make the economic argument for that. Parks cost money, they don't make money. And so instead it was sold off for private development. And so there's an exact example why we don't have the lovely green spaces and the people-friendly spaces because of how our councils are being funded currently.
I mean, austerity is a big part of it. Austerity has been an appallingly destructive economic project that's been imposed by Westminster. Too often it's been repeated in Scotland. The Greens have tried to prevent that. We've successfully reversed a number of really, really biting cuts to further cuts to the local government budget. Not enough. We haven't achieved perfection. We've never pretended that, but we've done our best to fight that. But it's not just austerity. It's also centralization of power, centralization of democratic power away from local communities. And it's also privatization, because that's another way of taking what should be democratically accountable power away from people's ability to make change. Privatization, centralization, and austerity are all part of this problem, and we need to have solutions to all of them.
So it wasn't just us that had our conference last week. Some other parties had their conference last week. So you've written a quote on our notes here that says, "Can't trust the Greens on climate." What's that? Who said that, and what's that all about?
Well, you know, sometimes there is a little bit of a knockabout that happens at party conference season. Everybody has a little pop at each other. But extraordinarily, Rosanna Cunningham from the SNP, the member of the cabinet with the responsibility for climate change, stood up at her party conference and said, "You can't trust the Greens on climate change." Absolutely breathtaking comment. And yeah, we all recognise that there's a bit of knockabout, and sometimes political parties can share an issue like independence and really disagree about other issues. But this was a pretty extraordinary one. And the fact that she was saying this at a conference whose climate session was sponsored by BP, one of the planet's climate criminals, just was completely extraordinary.
And at the same conference, they were committing to decades more of oil and gas extraction. Decades! I've read the IPCC report. I'm sure you've read it as well. We don't have decades. There are not decades. We have to stop that stuff within a decade. You know, yeah. That's where it has to realistically be. The SNP are terrible on climate. You know, they say climate emergency. I've heard them say it. But then do these things that are absolutely the opposite, that are not compatible with this. And you have to watch actions, not words in politics.
I think the problem is one of, you know, a contradiction between the good things that a party or a government is doing and the bad things that they don't want you to think about. You know, it's not that Scotland hasn't achieved a big increase in renewables. It has. Scotland's done really well on renewables. And sometimes, when there have been problems, it's been UK policies that are the cause of those problems, not Scottish policies. But at the same time, there is this desire to keep on asking for more subsidies and tax breaks for the fossil fuel industry. You know, it wasn't just BP who was sponsoring the SNP conference. Heathrow bought the drinks again. You know, Heathrow sponsorship. And Michael Matheson, the Transport Minister, made a speech about how we need to cut the amount of private car use in order to reduce air pollution in our cities. And just minutes later, in the grand prize for the SNP raffle, they gave away a car. You know, this level of contradiction, and it's not just the Greens who highlight that kind of contradiction. The Scottish Youth Climate Strike movement said it's unacceptable and disgraceful that the SNP conference was sponsored by Heathrow and BP. We will not put up with this blatant hypocrisy and disregard of our futures. That's not coming from the Scottish Green Party. That's not a party political quote. That's from the youth climate strikers who have put so much energy, creativity and hope into the climate movement. I think all political parties need to be recognising that the contradictions between what's done in their environment department and what's done in their transport or energy department or in their economic policy, these contradictions need to be ended if we're going to be serious about this agenda.
There was a headline I saw this week from, it was IATA, so the International Air Transport Association, I assume is what that stands for, and they were saying, "Flight shaming will slow growth in aviation industry." It's like, yes, that's the point. Growth in aviation industry, George Monbiot explained it really well. If you have 3% growth, that means you're doubling every 23 years. Mm. We are already on track for 6 degrees of warming, which means, you know, huge extinctions on our planet. There can be no more growth in the aviation industry. There has to be ramping down. Mm. Now, we don't currently have any replacement technology for aviation. So, you know, people always say, "Oh, you can't turn it off tomorrow." I'm not suggesting we turn it off tomorrow, but we need to plan to ramp it down.
Well, we certainly can replace a lot of the domestic flights. So just in the week after the SNP conference, it was revealed that their senior official in the SNP Scottish government has flown between the Central Belt and London four times more often than taking the train. You know, this is the person whose job is to tell other civil servants and officials you should travel sustainably and not fly all the time. She's quite right to make that call on everybody else, but then she treats aviation as casually as hopping on or off a bus in when she's making her own trip. So there really does need to be consistency. There is no reason why the Scottish government and the public sector in Scotland could not rule out domestic aviation within the mainland. You know, obviously there's a critical need for lifeline flights for the islands and some very remote communities. I don't think anyone disagrees with that. But the huge amount of traffic going between the Central Belt and London by air is unnecessary. We can replace that right now, not just with rail and other surface modes, but also by video conferencing, by reducing the demand for that the level of business flights that are happening on that short scale. But yeah, globally, we need to fly less, not more. And it's interesting that you highlighted that quote from the aviation industry, almost adopting the language of something like fat shaming, body shaming, saying flight shaming. You know, what's next? Is it greed shaming?
Yeah.
Is that what we're gonna?
Well, yeah. Well, I think we should.
I don't want people to feel ashamed of the choices that they make. I want and we need people to be able and willing to make better choices. The sustainable transport option always has to be the cheaper one. It always should be the more convenient one. And yes, it might take a little bit longer. It doesn't take much longer actually to get between Glasgow and London by train than it does by plane. In fact, if you're snarled up getting out of Heathrow, you might take longer by going by plane. But
and you can take your deodorant with you and and your juice bottle and you know.
But you know, yeah, we do need that kind of change. And the Scottish government, interestingly, when they finally, after years of pressure from the Greens, dumped their absurd policy of aviation tax cuts, cutting the air departure tax, the replacement for air passenger duty, they finally scrapped that policy on the basis of the climate emergency, they said. Well, if they're serious that that's a reason for not cutting aviation taxes, then the logical consequence of that is that nothing else, no other policy that increases aviation is justifiable either. So I would challenge them, dump your support for Heathrow expansion, dump your support for aviation growth, and let's plan a transition away from that high carbon transport mode toward giving people the options that are affordable and convenient and accessible to travel by public transport. And let's invest in the kind of public transport options people need on a daily basis, not just the those very occasional trips that people might need to take by air.
Okay, so here we are on Super Saturday.
we've
turned the sound off, but we've got the MPs in Westminster debating.
Oh, yeah, there's Ian Blackford is on his feet.
I know he is. Yeah. He's normally good to listen to. What is going on? And what is Caroline Lucas, who's our Green, well, not our Green MP, but Green Party of England and Wales, Green MP, what will she be voting for today? And what are we hoping for?
Well, she'll certainly vote against the Boris Johnson deal if it comes to the vote unamended. But there are a couple of amendments. One of those will effectively defer the meaning of today's vote until the legislation is passed. You know, any piece of legislation, a tiny, minor tweak to regulations, the kind of ministerial order that goes through Holyrood and Westminster all the time, any piece of legislation like that is subject to weeks, often months, of detailed scrutiny, opportunities for members of the public to feed in their views, for the affected organisations to say what impact it'll have, and then you have a vote. This so-called deal, I hate the language of deals, so Trumpy.
It's very Trumpy, isn't it? I was thinking that. Yeah.
We did a deal. This is a great deal. It's not. This agreement that's been reached between Boris Johnson and the EU has only been in the public domain for just under 48 hours now.
Yeah.
And MPs are expected to vote on it now. That's a piece of nonsense. If it passes, then they'll have to go through the process of scrutinising the legislation. But that will effectively simply be implementing a decision they've already made. So one of the amendments says the effect will be that we will proceed with the legislation, but the meaningful vote won't have happened. Mm. That means the Benn Act will be triggered and the UK government will be forced to write a letter asking for an extension. The Second Amendment attaches a referendum, a confirmatory vote, putting the power back with the people, because it's increasingly clear that you know, this the 2016 referendum was achieved on the basis of cheating, of lying, and of making false promises that could never be delivered.
And there's been no consultation process, which blows my mind. So as Greens, we're always very keen that politics isn't done to people, that people have a say and a choice in what they want their future to look like.
Absolutely.
And so the idea that the Tories kind of took this Brexit vote and ran with it without ever going back to the people, no citizens' assemblies, no consultations, no process at all to actually go, okay, you want Brexit, what does that mean? What do you actually want? It was all about secrecy and hiding and winning points and scoring this and that and headlines. It wasn't at all about, okay, you've made this choice, people of the UK, what does that mean? What does that look like? And going back and asking, and to someone who's a Green and really believes in that consultation and believes that you get a better result when you ask people what's meaningful to them, to just impose this on people is outrageous. It's an outrageous sort of perversion of democracy.
And no respect either for the devolution settlement. You know, the impact of this decision, even if you thought that the 2016 referendum was completely unproblematic, totally fair, legitimate, and should be accepted and implemented. You know, the UK is not a single unitary state. It never was even before devolution, but it certainly isn't now that you have more than one government within the UK, and still an open question about Scotland's future within the UK. Many of us already believed that Scotland was being treated shabbily by the UK government, and we would prefer to run our own affairs. But even those who are not, or you know, previously hadn't supported independence, would recognise there's more than one government, more than one parliament, more than one jurisdiction within the UK, and that needs to be respected. It hasn't been at all. The principle of consent is now being talked about in relation to Northern Ireland, specifically because of the border issues. You know, I think a lot of people in Northern Ireland are still rejecting what's in the proposed deal at the moment. But even to be as generous as I possibly could be to the UK government, you know, they would be then saying England voted leave and England gets to leave. Wales voted leave and Wales gets to leave. Northern Ireland voted remain, but they get some kind of mechanism to reflect consent to the new arrangements. That would leave Scotland as the only part of the UK, this alleged partnership of equals, that didn't consent to this process. Brexit as a whole, we voted overwhelmingly against it, hasn't consented to the arrangements of how it's going to be implemented, and isn't going to consent to this Boris Johnson deal. So, you know, there is a huge question, however the vote goes tonight, about, you know, Scotland's place in this absolute mess of a union.
Hashtag IndyRef2, hashtag ScotRef would be where I'd go with that one. Shall we wrap it up there and we'll talk again on Monday?
Yeah.
And we'll see how this all went and we'll...
By the time we know how the votes have been counted this evening, we'll have a little bit of a chance to reflect on that and on what's going to happen in the days, weeks, months to come. And, you know, Scotland's future is going to have to be back in Scotland's hands before very long.
Well, it's lovely to spend, well, quite a long time, 40 minutes talking with you about politics, Patrick. It's been super, and I'll see you again on Monday.